You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 2nd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Government and Social Studies at Harvard University, Daniel Ziblatt, on conservative parties and the birth of democracy. Meanwhile, relatively speaking, Democrats win big in the budget fight. A full disarmament by the Republicans and the Trump administration. But alas, Gorka gone. He will serve this country from a perch outside of the White House.
He'll still grift somewhere.
Yeah, oh yeah. No. He'll be screeching off in his Mustang, I guess, as they say. Meanwhile, Trump argues for a shutdown, which, just for you at home, is a very bad way of arguing that the shutdown is someone else's fault. Meanwhile, a big retirement in Florida. Very likely Democratic pickup in the House. Not necessarily a Democrat you're going to love, but speaking of which, Ossoff v. Handel in Georgia's 6th. Dead heat. And a great story of a big indivisible win in a West Virginian town. Meanwhile, the Democrats' autopsy is under wraps, but what we know of it, a little bit scary. The Hamas charter now recognizes Israel, as hundreds of conservative writers lose one of their key talking points.
Oh, no. They'll keep repeating it.
Meanwhile, Bill Fine out at Fox. What? Bill Shine. Bill Fine, for all I know, he left a long time ago. And the real question is Sean Hannity next? Meanwhile, 35 million people strike in Brazil. How's that? All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, I am back from Las Vegas. As you can see, the tone of my voice reflects not just a couple of days in Vegas, but also the subsequent. I took the red eye to come back because I had to do my son's preschool's auction fundraiser.
Hello.
Yes. And I drank a little too much.
Did you enjoy your time? Did you enjoy your time, Rachel?
Yes, I did.
That's what you're recovering from, is a preschool auction, Vegas?
No, not Vegas.
That's so
what he does,
Sam,
he gets loaded on wine spritzers.
If you'll also notice that I am just seeming slightly optimistic, that is because of the $392 I won at the tables.
What a high roller you are.
Yo, yeah. And if there's a little bounce in my step, that's probably what you're picking up on.
$392.
It was great. I bought some very nice gifts for everybody in my family. And everybody, they were all excited about it. So.
And then you had $300 left.
And then I had $382 left. just wanted to touch on a couple of things. We've gotten a lot of email about, obviously, the Arthur Bryant story of Public Citizen and their fight against Remington rifles. We heard from people who were the Abilify. The story about Abilify has been impacting their lives. Really crazy stuff. And obviously, we got, I got called both a Democratic shill and a Putin Assad apologist.
That is correct.
Max Blumenthal. And to be fair, I feel like I'm both those things.
I think that one of the distinct thing about this show is the way we are many different things to many different people.
But with that said, you know, there was some criticism as to why I wasn't more aggressive in pushing back on every aspect of the interview with Max Blumenthal. And, you know, I think some of the finer details, obviously, I've addressed in the past. And, you know, he's done far more reporting in this area than I have. With that said, you got to listen to what is speculation on his part and what is reported. And I will say this, though, putting aside some of the details as to whether or not the chemical attack was manufactured or whether it was a bomb of a warehouse or whatever it was, there's still some basic facts that I think, you know, everyone accepts, and that is the horror of Assad, the grave difficulty, if it's possible at all, to sort of parse out that there are Syrian rebels that we would want to be associated with, and the, I think, reality that if we were to fund them, we would elongate a conflict. But the important thing, too, I think, is that, you know, what struck me after that interview is that we're 14 years after invading Iraq. And there really doesn't seem to be any institutional bulwark against us rushing headlong into another conflict. I don't think we're in danger of that at this juncture, but I do feel like we can be a terrorist attack away from repeating all of that. And I noticed it when I went on the Hayes' show and just watched all these people just snap into line when it came to bombing Syria. And so I think, you know, I don't know how much of what we're doing around the world is a function of secret neoconservative plots or the fact that Donald Trump has basically outsourced everything to the military and as responsible as we are consistently told in just about every outlet as to these the leadership of these military characters. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, the military is probably not the first place you want to go to when you determine whether or not you should go to war. There is a certain incentive structure that they have that they may not themselves even be conscious of. I mean, when you're a hammer, it's not like you contemplate, like, am I really projecting onto everything that it's a nail?
Oh, can I just, and I think that there's no doubt that maybe there are people in the military that are slightly less likely to be inclined to support a certain reckless adventurism of like a neocon pundit. But by the same token, these are the same people that are obviously always going to say, loosen the rules of engagement.
Allow
us to drop more bombs. Allow us to kill more civilians.
Listen, military personnel thought that really, it should all be about diplomacy. Guess what they would do?
They would
go and join the diplomatic corps. I mean, so, you know, as reasonable as they are, I, you know, this is something that we should be very, very skeptical and worried about. And so, if the broader narrative supports that, I am supportive of that broader narrative because we should be. So, let me just say that. Let me just say the other thing is, if I seem a little bit distracted right now, it's because there's a box of Shari's Berries.
No. A box, dude.
There's a box of Shari's Berries.
You just got so mass with that.
Well, it's because I'm holding back. I feel like I'm almost drunk.
I want to give myself like a bath with like chocolate covered strawberries in my freaking face.
I'm 14 feet away from a box full of freshly dipped in chocolate strawberries.
Are you hungry, Rachel?
And it's honestly, it's driving me crazy. And what's the worst part is that I still remember the taste of the strawberry the last time.
Oh, really, Rachel?
Incredibly juicy. They're obviously very chocolatey, the goodness in those berries. But it's the strawberries I remember. And now, for Mother's Day, starting at $19.99 plus shipping. Mother's Day is right around the corner. Honestly, I remember where I was when I had that strawberry, and it's driving me crazy. It's an unexpected gift that will put a smile on any mom's face. Right now, you can double the berries for just $10 more. You just pick your delivery date, and your berries are guaranteed to arrive fresh and delicious, or your money back. The only way to get this amazing deal for berries starting at just $19.99 is to visit berries.com, berries.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the corner and use my code CEDAR, S-E-D-E-R, CEDAR. That's my last name, CEDAR, spelt like Seder. That's berries.com. Use the code CEDAR when you click on the mic. This amazing deal won't last long, and Mother's Day is right around the corner, so be sure to order now. Also, I have just used this product, and it doesn't haunt me in the same way that the berries do, but Away uses high-quality materials for its suitcases at a much lower price by cutting out the middleman and selling directly to you. You got three sizes. The carry-on, I have that one. The medium or the large. And I'm thinking, I'm going to get the medium and the large because the thing is they nest. They fit in each other. I think people understand what that means. All the suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate. They are unrivaled in strength and impact resistance and very lightweight. This is important for me because when I travel, more often than not, I've got like microphones and I've got my equipment. But, well, listen to what else this thing has. They have the 360-degree spinner wheels, which is an upgrade for me because I used to have just the two. And when you can go sideways in every different direction, it really does make a difference. They have a TSA combination lock built on the top of the bag to prevent theft. A removable, washable laundry bag that obviously keeps your dirty clothes separate from your clean. But it's also, this is the carry-on. This is what I love about it. And this is what sort of cracks me up about the. It can charge. It has two USB plugs. You power in the charger, you plug it in, forget about it, and then it can charge your cell phone or your tablets or your e-readers, anything else that's powered by a USB cord. A single charge of the Away carry-on will charge your iPhone 5 times. I have found Myla in my room, plugged into my suitcase. And I'm like, what are you doing? And she's like, I can't find the plug. She can't find the plug, so she plugs it into the suitcase. Plus, it's got a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they'll fix or replace it for you for life. 100-day trial. Live with it. Travel with it. Do whatever you do with a suitcase. I'm not going to ask. And if you don't like it after 100 days, they will refund it for you, and they will ask no questions. Free shipping on any Away order in the continental U.S. Like I say, it is a tough, durable suitcase. Nice looking. And the charging thing is really, really helpful. And it doesn't take up any space. For $20 off your first order, or any order, I guess, visit awaytravel.com/majority. Use the promo code majority during checkout. That's awaytravel.com/majority. Use promo code majority during checkout. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Professor Daniel Zyblatt.
It's not like Mr. Sh-
are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Daniel Ziblatt. He is professor of government at Harvard University, and his latest, Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, we should just say that the broad, perspective that you take on this question of democracy is one that you look at sort of the constraining forces, I guess, rather than the pro-democracy forces as you look at the development of democracy in Europe. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the way we normally think about democracy, and I think there's a lot to this, is to think about the forces pushing for democracy. Historically, this is the middle class, working class groups demanding the right to vote and so on. But what motivated me to write this book was the idea that we tend to, our works, the scholarship, and also the way we think about this, tends to be quite silent on those who are conceding the democratic reforms. And so I was interested in trying to look at things from their perspective and to think about how they shaped the process of democratization.
And let's look at you focus to a large extent on Britain and in Germany, and I want to look at this, and I also obviously and I think you've written some pieces as of late. To the question of just how tenuous democracy is in this country at this time in particular.
Right.
But let's start with, I mean, give us a sense of who those forces who had to sort of let go and why in the development of democracy in Britain.
Yeah, so I'm primarily focusing on the 19th through the mid-20th century in this work. And there's one person in particular that really sort of paradigmatic, I guess, of the kinds of people I'm interested in, Lord Salisbury, who was a large landowner in 19th century Britain in the House of Lords. I actually did archival work in his home, this huge landed estate outside of London. And I was walking down his archives are in the basement there, and you go upstairs and there are these kind of long marble hallways with portraits of families going back several centuries, and they'd controlled the political system for hundreds of years, were among the wealthiest people in Britain. And, early on, he kind of sounded a bit, incredibly frightened actually of democracy in the 1860s, saying that democracy is the right of eight beggars to govern seven Rothschilds, and what is more, to tax them. But by the 1880s, 1890s, he had kind of come to terms with this. And so I was just interested in tracing his kind of process of acclimatizing himself to democracy and how this came about.
What was, I mean, let me ask you this, I guess. Is what happened in terms of his sort of, acceptance, personal acceptance, is there an analog as a broader societal movement within, the aristocracy or those in power,
right.
I guess.
Yes. Yeah, so anywhere, I mean, I think in general, democracy is a threat to those with power and money and status in a pre-democratic setting, as well as in our own society. There's a lot to lose when the forces of democracy are unleashed. And so there are going to always be opponents to democracy, and so the defenders, in some sense, of the status quo. And so this guy that I mentioned is kind of, again, just an exemplar of this. And so the question then is, how do these people who are frightened of democracy, who are kind of clinging on to power, under what conditions do they release power? Is it just simply the level of threat they face? And I really focus on whether or not these types of figures have access to political parties. And I think actually political parties are a major invention in the 19th century, conservative political parties. And once landed elites, aristocrats, had gained access to political parties, they then realized they could concede democracy without necessarily conceding power, because they could now compete and win elections. So this was a major innovation that I sometimes think we take for granted.
That that there was actually a vehicle that still sort of favored them on some level, right? Where they could translate their money into there may be a little bit more work involved. But, I mean, to a certain extent, just as we're talking about it, it just sort of reminds me of FDR, cutting a deal with those who wouldn't want Social Security. It's like, look, We can do this the hard way, or we can do it the easy way.
Right, that's right. And so, you know, given the threat of revolution, which in some ways this is always latent, you know, a kind of forces for real social transformation, then democracy in some sense emerged as, by which I mean, you know, the expansion of the suffrage, parliamentary or kind of representative control over executives, the emergence of civil liberties, this kind of institutionalized way of organizing politics is a kind of nice compromise. And it turns out, you know, you would rather have conservatives playing the democratic game than resisting it and rejecting it, even, you know, at all costs. So this is a major achievement, in fact, and a major contribution to democracy historically. And in a lot of countries, it turns out, and I look at Germany, this didn't happen. I mean, there were conservatives who just resisted till the bitter end because they hadn't really made the same discovery of that political parties could protect them. And so as a result of this, you got a kind of much more radicalized right-wing response to the forces of democracy into the 20th century.
Well, I mean, let's go into that, because I guess the paradox here is that the parties, on one hand, they can be a vehicle. On the other hand, their absence can moving ahead with a democratic project, Big D, without this sort of outlet and without empowering everyone can be bad.
That's right. And so it is a paradox in the sense that, you know, if one thinks that the conservatives were opposed to democracy, and yet when they are well organized, this actually facilitates democratic stability. That's essentially the argument. So in some sense, the argument sounds like a conservative argument. But I do think that the alternatives are, you know, in social instability and emergence of a kind of right-wing radicalism that rejects democratic politics, a kind of populist politics that would be familiar to us today. I mean, this emerged in the 1890s in Germany, partly in response to the fact that that conservative, the kind of equivalent to Lord Salisbury in Germany. So these are kind of the Tory conservatives in Germany, just didn't get their act together to organize politically. And so they lost control of the political game to much more dangerous right-wing forces. And so, you know, having a kind of stable center-right party is actually a precondition possibly to democracy. And I think, you know, when you look around the world today, also you do happen to, you know, you see this as certainly resonates.
And I mean, when you say that, are there no parties on the spectrum that aren't, or at least a stable left, center-left party? I mean, because obviously, if there's no impetus for democracy, there wouldn't be, right?
I mean, yes. No, absolutely. I mean, I don't think, you know, this is not a kind of single variable explanation that explains everything. I mean, I think that at some level, there needs to be democratic forces clamoring for democratic reform, clamoring for the expansion of the suffrage. But simply a kind of well-organized left or well-organized pro-democratic forces are not sufficient. I mean, that's one way to think about it, that there needs to be a counterpart on the other side of the political spectrum that's willing to play the democratic game. And so to give you a kind of more contemporary example, you know, so if we think of Egypt after the Arab Spring and the fall of Mubarak, you know, one of the things that happened was that Mubarak's party was banned. And so there was no kind of authoritarian successor party. And so as a result of this, it was harder for these guys to win elections. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood came into power. And once the representatives of the old regime were not able to compete electorally, really the only option at some level was a military coup. I mean, to kind of simplify it a bit. So again, the options are, are you going to have, you know, former authoritarians, who in many cases in the historical context of Europe, that's who the conservatives were, are you going to convince them to play the democratic game or not? And I think a big part of that really is, again, this kind of discovery of political parties, the elevation of party professionals. You know, I sometimes think, you know, that somebody like Karl Rove or, you know, kind of modern kind of political advisors are people who thrive in a democratic setting. So you need these kinds of guys around for the right in order for the democratic game to proceed.
I mean, there's almost an analog, too, I would imagine, in post-invasion of Iraq. I mean, if you suppress a huge part of the population and more or less undermine their political representation, it's very often a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, so there's really this dilemma. What do you do with these former authoritarian groups, and so, you know, the Ba'athist you know, if you're referring to the Baathist kind of, yep. Elimination of the Baathist forces from society. I mean, after World War II, a similar kind of dilemma of, you know, what do you do with the Nazis, you know, the former Nazis and post-World War II Germany. And so this is always a dilemma of how do you deal with the old regime? And it's certainly, you know, there's no single answer, but I think one, you know, certain, you know, people who commit crimes certainly should be prohibited from participating in politics. But at some level, you know, we can't simply wish away, entire sections of the population. I mean, people, you know, all segments of the population have a kind of right to participate in politics. And so making room for them and encouraging them to organize in a way that allows them to think they have a viable chance of winning elections, at least some of the time, is a great way to convince people to participate in politics. I mean, if there's some sense in which, you know, if you play the Democratic game, you're not going to win power. Then this is a kind of a quick route to kind of convincing people to go outside of the democratic procedures to try to gain power, you know, especially if they have a lot to lose with the democratic system.
Is like the truth and reconciliation system, I guess, in post-apartheid South Africa, is that an example of one how you sort of?
Yeah. These things have to get negotiated. I mean,
right.
You know, we tend to have this view that democracy is the overturning of the old social order, but that's really, you know, the way that most stable democracies come into being is, you know, through this, you know, there has to be a lot of pressure for change. I mean, I'm not downplaying the importance of democratic activists and so on, but there needs to be some negotiation and bargaining that takes place to, you know, make sure that elites aren't, you know, former elites aren't completely excluded. Now, you know, there's two ways of doing this, by the way. I mean, one way is to kind of write into the Constitution a series of deals for the old elites. And so Chile, after Pinochet, you know, gave the military autonomy over its budget, you kind of have unelected offices, you know, unelected upper chambers. You kind of hardwire these things into the Constitution. That's one way. This in some ways giving up some bit of democracy in order to get stability. I'm proposing something that's sort of, the lesson that comes out of the book that's really, you know, a historical book. The idea is that we don't have to kind of give away these constitutional kind of guarantees. Instead, what, you know, if the former elite can organize themselves as political parties, this can assure their self-interest in a way that promotes democratic competition. So in some ways, I think it's a kind of superior solution to the more traditional way of thinking about, you know, carving out constitutional guarantees to old regime elites.
And so when we look at, for the folks that had a question as to whether or not Donald Trump was set to be this is going to sound a little bit like hyperbole, but the next Hitler or
right.
some
yeah.
other figure that would be Hitlerian, I guess.
Right.
It has less to do with him as a figure and more to do with the context and the weakness of a system or the failure of a system to address certain people's interests.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think it's, you know, that analogy, of course, is really provocative and so on. So, but I think one way to think about this is that parties of the left, but, you know, what I'm focusing on is really parties of the center-right, have to serve as gatekeepers to keep extremists out of their midst, and effective parties, in any coalition, you know, politics is about coalition. In any coalition, there's going to be people of differing views on things. And so there's going to be moderates and there's going to be more extremists. And so for democracy to work, the center right has to be dominated by people who, the political machinery of the party has to be dominated by people who are willing to play the democratic game. And so once a party loses its ability to control, you know, who gets the nomination for president or for any office, then the party is kind of losing its monopoly on what it's supposed to be doing. I mean, what a party does is deliver nominees and has a monopoly. And if party leaders can't control their own nomination process, then this suggests this is a kind of broken party. And so in the case of Donald Trump, what certainly happened was this was somebody who won the nomination, who, you know, anybody who would count as a party leader didn't initially support him. So the question of how this happened is of course a fascinating one that people are still trying to think about today. But this there is an analog to, in the 1920s, the center-right party, and this, I describe this in the book, I have two chapters on the Weimar Republic, where I, it's really, and again, it's historical, not about contemporary America, but, you know, when reading it, the lessons can be drawn from it, certainly, or people have told me that, you know, as they read it, they see these parallels, where in the Weimar Republic, you had a center-right party that was playing the democratic game, and a figure came in, and it was a weak party, kind of loosely organized, decentralized party that didn't have, had financial problems, and a media mogul, Alfred Hugenberg, came along, and I described this in great detail in the book. He owned movie theaters and newspapers. He came along and financed all the local party associations and then had himself elected as party chairman of the party. He had no political experience, never run in, you know, run for elected office, and here he was suddenly the chairman of the center-right party, and he pushed the party far to the right. And this was in the late 20s, and this in many ways was a kind of precursor to the democratic breakdown. So if there's any analogies to that period, I kind of look to the kind of analogy of Hugenberg and Donald Trump, as somebody who took over the party, a kind of center-right party, and has moved it in ways, you know, in the U.S. it's still uncertain what's going to happen, but in Germany it was certainly clear this party then moved to the right.
You also write about the conservative dilemma, all right? Is it predicament, yes, or dilemma? And to, yes, me, that seems to tie into the ascension of Donald Trump from my perspective. Why don't you talk about the dilemma,
I describe and this goes back to the 19th century. I mean, conservatives, you know, historically, were in 19th century Europe, were the defenders of wealth, status, and prestige, and power. And so, to win the democratic game, they were kind of playing this rear guard action where, if, you know, democracy means expanding the suffrage and the majority wins, most people are not the wealthy and the powerful. So this was the initial dilemma that conservatives faced in the 19th century, which is how to win elections, majoritarian elections, when they are not a majority of the population. And so what conservatives in the 19th century in Germany, Britain, and elsewhere had to do was to begin to talk about other issues that could appeal to people, you know, who simply on economic grounds would not sort of find a natural home with the conservatives. So if conservatives, you know, initially represented landed elites, and these parties were often, at least in Germany, Britain in particular, founded by landed elites, to appeal to a wider segment of the population, they had to appeal to voters on essentially non-economic grounds initially. So this meant often becoming defenders of religion, traditional values, nationalism. And so these became the themes through which 19th century British and German conservatives built a much wider base and were able to kind of perform more successfully. So they kind of faced this dilemma of how do you win elections when you are defending a group that's not going to be the majority party. And then once you begin to activate these issues of religion and nation and so on, can you actually deliver on this? And if you can't, then you've now activated this population who's going to expect something from conservatives that they are not delivering on. And so that, in a sense, is the dilemma that conservatives historically faced. And, you know, it would be interesting to think about how this dilemma, if it exists in the contemporary period as well.
Well, I mean, I think the dynamic of, at the very least, of the center right, I mean, the Republican Party, coming up with an agenda and trying to figure out how they can sell that agenda when it's really not in the best interest of a vast majority of Americans. I mean, I think that's, you know, we get things like the death tax instead of the estate tax, which, you know, impacts less than 1% of our population. How do you get 50% of the people to sign on to something that has absolutely no impact on them but for decreasing their mobility? I mean, and then it becomes these, you know, at that time that were more religious, but I think there's more sort of identitarian, you know, all these people who voted for Donald Trump didn't own guns, but guns rights are a very big issue. They even for a while, I think the idea of like the deficit, you know, not under Donald Trump, but for a while was a sort of a loosely held social identity, check off. I don't think a lot of people had any sense of what it meant to them on a daily basis. They just sort of took it for rote. And it seems like those agendas plus the failure of the sort of, I guess, the dispersal of the establishment's resources combined in this sort of perfect storm for Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah, you know, and the thing about, you know, these, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And you know, in some ways, contemporary conservatives are much more sophisticated than 19th century conservatives who, you know, this kind of invention of these kind of key terms like the death tax and so on are a way of using economic issues to appeal to broader segments of the population, or emphasizing the importance of mobility rather than inequality, these kinds of slogans and ideas and so on. And so, but I think on the other hand, one thing that's worth mentioning is the creative invention of policy ideas to try to appeal to more people is in fact part of the democratic process. So, you know, one may disagree with the kind of, you know, the death tax, you know, calling this a death tax, or one may disagree with, you know, an emphasis on budget deficits. And, you know, one may kind of point out the irony of this, and I think that's right to do that. But on the other hand, at least this is playing the democratic game.
Right.
You know, where things get very, you know, at some level, this is, you know, so this is in some ways the kind of the two-edged sword of this. On the one hand, we may not like this, but on the other hand, they're playing this is playing the democratic game, and the responsibility of the opposite side in the political game is to come up with better ideas. And this is what democratic politics is about, is a kind of effort to frame issues in a way that can appeal to the most people. That the situation becomes dangerous when the democratic game is not played. So under what conditions does that happen? It's sort of when these ideas either are not delivered upon for a sufficient amount of time that the kind of base begins to say, well, you know, forget this. We don't even believe, you know, what our Republican leaders are telling us anymore, because they too are lying to us. And there's a kind of a willingness to suspend any kind of interest in democratic competition. And so I think that the kind of long run effect, so in the short run anyway, playing this kind of game with frames and issues is good, and it's in some sense, because it's promoting democratic competition. You may not, you know, want that side of the debate to win, but at least both sides are participating. But over the long run, this does generate, you know, if not delivered upon, and if the party's not able to control and respond to its kind of constituents' demands, there are been these kind of populist uprisings against the conservative establishment, and that's again, I think, what we've witnessed over the last 2 years.
I mean, what do you see in the context of current day that are threats to democracy as opposed to just threats to people? Right. I mean, like the rollback of the Affordable Care Act does not necessarily signify a threat to democracy. I mean, a lot of people are going to suffer and maybe even die. But in terms of the institution of democracy, are there things that sort of say like, oh, boy, that sounds eerily reminiscent. That's bad.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, not to diminish at all the policy. Debate.
But we're talking about more of the structure of our society rather than the outputs.
Right, exactly. So it's really the basic rules of the political game. And it's, you know, and so the reason that these are so important to think about these things is that this shapes the long run battles, you know, over the next 100 years, what are political battles, or even over the next 5 years, what's political conflict and political debate going to look like? And so, so the terms under which all of these policy issues are decided. And yeah, so I think that's a really useful distinction. And, you know, again, you may not like the policies of the opposite side, and that's what politics is about, is trying to come up with better arguments. But there's ways in which the basic rules of the game can be challenged that tilt the playing field in a way that makes the competition unfair. And so the kinds of specific things that do that are, you know, at a very basic level, more traditional things such as restricting the right to vote through various indirect means at state level. And so this has happened, you know, with voter ID laws and so on. At some level, this is partly about, under the kind of neutral sounding label of, you know, of cleaning up elections, about tilting the playing field against one side. And these are indirect efforts to restrict the suffrage, I would argue. So that's kind of one big dimension. At the national, so this is happening a lot at the level of, you know, at U.S. states. I mean, this is what U.S. is a federal system. But at the national level, I think anything that goes after, I mean, in some ways you can think of that the political system as being a political game, as I've used that analogy before, in which you have neutral umpires. And so these are courts, bureaucracies, ethics offices. And the degree to which incumbents in power try to co-opt or sort of capture the referees of the political game. This is a danger. So, you know, if the court system is in some ways tilted, and so this has happened in other countries, in Hungary and Turkey, where, you know, kind of arbitrary retirement age is introduced, and so you kind of force the retirement of a bunch of judges, you know, giving the incumbent the ability to simply, you know, load up the court with his allies, you know, or so intimidating Donald, judges. And so, yeah.
When Donald Trump says, I mean, it's one thing for Donald Trump, I guess, to criticize rulings, but when Donald Trump says, like, you know, we should break up the Ninth Circuit, I mean, those type of things, we start to cross a threshold, no? Or
yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And so, and you know, you may say, well, it's just words. I mean, I don't know, the specific proposal about the ninth, about this particular circuit, I'm not, you know, for discussion, this is a large circuit. But, you know, in any case, anything, our alarm bells should go off when we hear this kind of proposal. That's absolutely right. This, as well as media. I mean, this is another neutral referee. You know, so attacking the media, trying to discredit the media is a similar kind of tactic that has been used in changing libel laws, which is, you know, something that's been floated. I mean, this is how Orban has arrested journalists, shut down newspapers. That's Erdogan in Turkey as well. I mean, as well as in Hungary, where there's been kind of efforts to control what the media are reporting through kind of governing boards and so on. So any effort to kind of shape the behavior of the referees, even you know, using just words. You know, we sometimes think, well, it's just words, that nothing's happened yet. But in most cases, when we look around the world, actions follow from words. I mean, words kind of predict where things are going, and it's a process of kind of discrediting these neutral arbiters, ethics offices as well. You know, the independence of the bureaucracy, any independent agencies, these things that have been designed to be neutral referees, the degree to which the incumbent tries to threaten these things, I mean, we really should be paying attention.
What about money? I mean, you know, because it's quite clear that the enormous amounts of money that have been spent, in particular, I think, by the Koch brothers. I mean, they are in and of themselves a force. You know, they supposedly have a better voter file than the Republican Party. I mean, they in particular, but more broadly speaking, it begins to undercut those structures that you're talking about. And, you know, on one hand, my feeling is like, well, you know, I mean, I don't particularly like either one, the Republican Party or the Koch brothers. Yeah. What's the difference? Or is it just that when you have that much money that is translated into political power, it necessarily undercuts democracy almost definitionally?
Yeah, so there's certainly an argument out there. That, I mean, that we can think that concentrations of wealth, economic inequality, it just by definition is incompatible with political equality. I mean, the tension, of course, is that, you know, in the way this is, you know, Citizens United case was decided back in 2010, which freed up expenditures, you know, this is free speech. And so there's this kind of dilemma that, you know, that, and in some ways, you know, I mean, I tend to think that there should be, you know, more control on spending. And you know, and so I think that the Citizens United decision was not a great decision at all. But I guess my critique is slightly different. I mean, coming out of the historical material in my book again, which is that I would rather the parties have a monopoly on spending than have groups that are in some ways much less accountable have access to this funding. So, my basic, you know, in this, you know, we may think, well, let's let the grassroots, let everybody spend money. This is good. But I tend to think really that political parties are broad coalitions. They try to win elections. And so as a result of that, they have to balance and moderate. And so there's, you know, many people with different interests, and the parties kind of crystallize the interests in a way and try to come up with the best candidate to win office. When you have groups that have very narrow interests, that have very specific interests, you know, changing a particular tax law or changing particular, you know, laws that represent their narrow interests, then you're going to get a politics that's much less inclusive, and you're going to have groups pushing for narrow agendas that are not in the interests of the general public. So I would rather have political parties with that monopoly over spending, and limit the ability of outside groups to shape the political agenda. And if outside groups want to shape the political agenda, they can do this through the vehicle of political parties. So I'm a great admirer in the sense of a very unpopular institution, which is political parties. I mean, I think were a great invention historically, and they, you know, there's something that are in some ways falling apart all around the world. And I think the result of that we see all around the world with a kind of much more polarized populist politics.
Is there? Do you have research, or are there examples of the opposite happening? I mean, I guess maybe that's it, right? Yeah. I mean, you look at the example of Britain and Germany in those early years. I mean, I think people forget that German democracy wasn't. I mean, I guess I don't know. I'm trying to do the math, but it's like
not till 1945. I mean, Germany wasn't even a country till 1871.
Yeah, you know? So you're not. And it doesn't have a long history. At least we've got 200 years under our belt plus.
Yeah,
which
that's right.
Would theoretically make it a little bit more durable.
That's right. I think that's right. But, you know, looking just, you know, at the moment, what's clear, I think, is that if you compare, let's say, France and Germany, I mean, this is a useful comparison, contemporary France and Germany. I mean, we have the French presidential elections coming up on Sunday, and you have two people running for office, Macron, who's not affiliated with a political party, and Marine Le Pen, who has been affiliated with this right-wing populist party, but now has actually, you know, since she's no longer officially connected to the party. So you have two people not connected to political parties. You have a socialist party, which historically has been strong, and a center-right party not making it to the second round. So you have a complete disintegration of the mainstream political parties. The result of that is, I think, what we see, which is, you know, very likely chance, or possible chance anyway, that Marine Le Pen could win. And so, you know, if you compare this to Germany, where the Christian Democratic Party under Angela Merkel is in power and continues to do well and, you know, may well win the elections this fall, and you have a Social Democratic Party that has also weakened a bit but is actually doing, you know, pretty well, you have a much more robust party system where you have these political parties that are able to contain these same sorts of forces. And I think when you have parties fall apart, then it just opens the door for forces that we don't like. I mean, that's, or, you know, that I don't like, put it that way.
Do you have any concern about the, and this is sort of outside of that, of your paradigm a little bit, but where we have a situation where, and maybe, you know, we're too old of a country to have this worry. I wonder about that. But when Donald Trump basically says, like, yeah, I'm ceding the agenda to the generals, because it's not really, I mean, in many respects, I mean, it's been my observation that it's not just Donald Trump that is ceding a large swath of responsibilities that the president usually handles to the generals. But I feel like commentators and observers are also sort of saying, like, you know, McMaster's and Mattis, they're our last refuge. That to me seems like a scary dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that sadly is very familiar. I mean, that, you know, so again, you know, recognize, I always have to add the caveat, recognizing all the differences between, you know, historical interwar Europe and in contemporary America, where in the U.S. certainly we're much, as you say, we're much more long-standing democracy, but that doesn't mean you can't point to certain parallels. And so, you know, in the years, the interwar years between World War One and World War Two, where you had this, you know, sudden boom in lots of democracies, there was a fascist challenge in lots of countries, a communist challenge, you know, it's both anti-democratic forces pushing from the far right and the far left. And there was a willingness in a kind of to tolerate military rule in some countries as a way of defending a country from these much more radical threats. And so, you know, Franco in Spain in some ways was an effort, you know, it was an effort to establish some more traditional order. In Hungary, you had a kind of similar thing where an admiral took over. I mean, so you have these situations where these are kind of almost like conservative revolutions, where you have this kind of forces of stability and, you know, relative reason emerging as a better alternative than the kind of the much more disruptive forces. And so, you know, it's so when we say, oh, well, we feel, you know, grateful that we have the adults in the room, McMaster and, you know, and so on, then, you know, and it's a little, you're right. It's kind of a kind of interesting commentary on the state that we're in, that these are preferable actors. You know, and certainly these guys are appointed, you know, cabinet, you know, appointees, but there is a way in which I think it's that, you know, when there's a kind of weakness of conservatism, you know, or the kind of fractured nature of conservatism often gives rise to kind of radicalization is one point I would make. But a second point I would make is it gives rise to dysfunction, where you have an increasingly kind of perceived system of stalemate and dysfunction, legislative stalemate, where nothing gets done. And there's more and more willingness to kind of tolerate the idea, well, we need somebody kind of strong to come along and sort of shape, whip things into action, and whip things into shape. And so that's sort of in a way, you know, I think we're still at a quite low stage of that in the U.S. And that, you know, hopefully this kind of moment will pass. But there is this tendency and a temptation that's always there, or a certain appeal to it. Anyway.
I mean, certainly, I think that was part of Donald Trump's appeal to a certain segment of the population, which is like, you know, somewhere between, I don't care, nothing's happening for me anyways, blow it up. You know, he can't do any worse than anybody else. To like, this is the guy who built the ice rink. He can do anything.
Right. Yeah. The ice rink. Yeah. I was always impressed with that. What a small scale operation that was. But this is not.
It's not even a structure. There's not even a structure over it. It's just a flat slab. Right.
Yeah, it's it's not new in our history, though. I mean, one thing that we sometimes think this is entirely new. I mean, I was just recently reading about Henry Ford. You know, there was this push to get him to run for president in 1924, and he was sort of playing coy with it, and he had this interview in which with Collier's Magazine, which he said, if I were president, and he said, I don't know if I could accept the nomination. I might do it in the future, but the main thing is that if a crisis comes, the nation might want someone who can do things quickly, and I could maybe serve that role. So no, this is something that's happened in the past, and so in that case, of course, he didn't even run though. So that was not much of a threat in some ways. But this is part of democratic politics that this tendency comes up when things aren't going well.
Daniel Ziblatt, the book is Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. And we will put a link to your book at majority.fm.
Great. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Well,
sometimes you need a man on a white horse to get a fucking job done.
There you go.
Nothing you'd understand, Rachel.
Why are you doing that so much?
Sometimes I have a fear that
looks like Rachel fucking
our guests will tune into the show as soon as they hang up and be like, what did I just do? Who allowed me to be booked on this show?
It is an elaborate setup for a morning zoo show. We desecrate historical figures. We have a very patient audience that will sit through you blabbing for 35 minutes about your historical research just to set up a joke, Professor.
Oh, my God.
Suck it.
Sam has, a complete beard. Stop calling him Rachel Maddow today.
Is this what you think he is?
I
would never insult Sam that much. I don't think that's a complete beard. He can grow an actual beard.
I can grow a beard. Yeah. That's Devin Shave.
I just feel like you're insulting Rachel Maddow.
God forbid I'm insulting Rachel Maddow. Hey, does everyone want to hear my Rachel Maddow impression? I'm Rachel Maddow. Russia. Hillary. Russia, woman, lesbian, Hillary, Russia.
Oh, my God.
That's my impression of Rachel Maddow.
All right, folks. Well, we're going to take a break. And did people see the President's show this week while I was in Vegas? It was the show that I was talking about, that Comedy Central show.
Just the clip that we're going to play in the fun half.
Where it's not James Amanek. It's Anthony Amanek.
Oops.
And
I think Michael did that.
There's a clip. We'll play this clip because when I saw this, I actually saw it. I did their first practice show and I was their guest. And I watched this at, UCB theater and I was crying at this.
You want to just play it before we go to the fun half?
Yeah. Let's play it before we go to the fun half. This is really funny.
It's very
okay.
Good.
So basically let me just set this up. Are you playing the whole clip? Or okay, just where he starts, okay. So the idea is that this show on Comedy Central, it's on Thursdays, I guess. It's, and this is really, the premise is really hard to sort of wrap your hands around. Imagine if the president was like a huge narcissist and decided while he was president that he would also like to do a TV show that was basically a late night show. And it's really hard to get your arms around that. And
yeah,
this guy, Anthony Atomenik, who toured with James Adomian. Adomian was Bernie and Anthony was Trump. They had these rolling debates.
James
around.
Adomian does a great Bernie.
Okay.
Psych.
So they take Trump around town, and at one point he's theoretically sitting in, I took this to be Queens. I don't think it's actually in Queens, but I took it to be Queens, like he was visiting his old stomping grounds, and he's just sitting there, and he's a little bit sullen. And I know it's a brownstone, but I'm sure there's a brownstone in Queens. But the idea being that
he doesn't want to be out.
He doesn't want to
be back at the tower.
And and then it takes it from here.
I want to go back to the tower, Bridget.
We're almost done, sir. Anything else you want to show us?
I don't know. A truck. Oh boy! Oh boy! Oh boy! Oh boy! There we go. Yeah, honk, honk. Honk, honk goes the truck. Honk, honk goes the truck. Honk, honk goes the truck. Did you guys see? The truck goes honk, honk. Did you see that? Did you see it? Unbelievable. It's so crazy. And you see how it moves? Big trucks, big wheel. And the big wheels go around. And then when you pull on the horn goes crazy. And the truck's so unbelievable because it's a tremendous truck. I wish we had a bigger truck. Wouldn't it be great if a big truck came? Like a big truck, a big 18-wheeler truck, and they're all down. And then a guy showed up, and he was a macho guy. And he says to me, you drive the truck. And then I get to drive the truck, and I get to go all the way down, and I drive it right into the river. And then I drown in the river, and I feel the water seeping over me. And then the air leaves my lungs. And in the moment where my body starts to react and wants air, I let go. And when I let go, the water fills my lungs, and I'm finally at peace. And only then do I find the complete and absolute solitude that I've wanted. Anyway, I want to go home, Bridget. I'm tired of
it. I was dying. I was dying.
That is so deep.
Yeah, it was
oh my
so
God,
dark.
That's so,
so
good.
Dark.
That's so good.
Apparently, he improvised all of that too. I think it was right around the time that the truck picture came out.
The truck picture.
And where Trump was like,
no, the way he caught, because Trump does have those moments. Like, remember we played the clip with the governor of Michigan. Where they were like, yeah, why doesn't Governor Schneider get in the picture? And he's like, yeah, he can get in the picture even though he didn't vote for me. And they're kind of like, oh, you remember everything. And then he gets this incredibly
dark
like, vindictive look.
Remember,
of, I remember
my father
everything.
Touch me there.
Right. So that way that he's able to slip, like sassy Trump captures like just the daily deluge of like just this petty, disgusting narcissist, but the way he flipped into that.
Well, that's what
that's more
what's
subtle,
really
like, whoa.
Interesting about his impression is that he's actually there's a it can get pretty dark. The show is, I think it's just gonna get better. So
a
worth
track.
Checking out.
A track. And even the way he does it, what's so brilliant too is that when he's doing that, he's excited, he still is like pursing his lips and looking like doing that kind of dumb serious
yes.
face that he
yes.
makes, but he's hopping up and
like when he says, wouldn't it be good if a big truck came?
All right, we got to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. If you have the financial means, please join themajorityreport.com, where you can sign up. JustCoffee.coop. You missed the 30%, but if you use the coupon code MAJORITY, you will get 10% off of your Just Coffee, including a free shipping. And also, if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, head over to MajorityReportKickback.com. Click on the link. Buy all your stuff through there. We get a kickback. And thus we call it MajorityReportKickback.com. We will take your calls and IMs in the fun half. She
is like the doll. She says no, 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 no. And though she'd like to fall, she says no, 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 no. She says, you are just a friend to me. Say yes.